Hi, I'm Jillian. I'm from the University of Vermont. I studied college students and their and education's effect on their opinions and willingness to be vaccinated. I'd like to say a special thank you to my thesis mentor who's here in the audience, Dr. Bert Wilkie. And thank all of you for coming out on a early Wednesday morning. No relationships to disclose. Okay, so my study focused on what would affect college students' opinions of immunization and what initially college students' knowledge of immunizations was, specifically the influenza vaccine. So for this study, we sent out emails to 2,000 undergraduate students at the University of Vermont. This is over a course of about 2 months, and about 345 students completed this survey, which was kind of long. It was about 20 minutes long. So what they did, there were two groups. So 1,000 students were group one, 1,000 students were group two. It broke down eventually to the 345 students. It was about 50-50. Group one received a survey, which we'll talk about a little bit later, a fact sheet, which was an intervention, and then the survey again to determine the effect of the intervention. Group two is about the same, except they also received a pro-immunization statement. The reason I did these two groups was to determine if a pro-immunization statement would have an increased effect on people's or students' opinions on vaccination before and after receiving the intervention. So, our questions, there are 20 questions. There are 13 questions that were knowledge-based. So, do you know people with an allergy to what should not get vaccinated with the influenza vaccine? Most of us know that's eggs. I said chocolate and other things, so it's a multiple-choice question. And most of the students got that right, just to let everyone know. And then there are 7 ethics-based questions. Things like, I am concerned for other members of the community during flu outbreaks, or I believe that vaccines will prevent me from getting sick. So, the fact sheet, general information about influenza, what you can do to prevent it. And then there was the pro-immunization statement, which is up here. It was focused on the fact that when you get an immunization, it is for other people, less for you. I thought that was a more effective message for college students. And to write these two, I used a lot of information from the CDC. Also, for the ethics part of the question, I focused on the health belief model. This is a somewhat complicated graph of it. It was written in the 70s, and it was very helpful to me. It's a tiny little blue book. But what I focused on was perceived susceptibility and seriousness, as well as perceived benefits and barriers. And what my intervention was, it was a cue to action. So, to go into a little bit more about the health belief model and the immunization, perceived susceptibility and perceived seriousness go down with the decrease of vaccine-preventable diseases. And I found that to be pretty interesting. I'll talk about that a little bit later. But perceived benefits and barriers, I wanted to focus a lot on barriers because college students have a tendency to refuse vaccines because of lots of different reasons. So the two types of barriers that we found were physical, so lack of access to healthcare, and inability to pay for immunization. At University of Vermont, all of the students have healthcare, so they should be getting vaccinated. So that was less of a concern for college students. But cognitive barriers, which we see a lot in not only college students, but also in parents, where such things like apathy or ideological opposition. So, why did I want to study college students? It's a formative time in their lives. They're receiving information from everywhere. Might as well give them a little bit of information about vaccines. They're also in high risk. They're also at a high risk for contracting disease. If anyone's been in a college dorm, you know that they're not exactly the cleanest things. What I didn't put in this presentation, but the demographic for people refusing vaccines are often middle class, highly educated, often women with a family and middle-aged. So this, the college students are poised to be that next group of parents to be vaccinating their children, and that group that specifically refuses vaccines for ideological reasons. So why don't college students get immunized? There's this thing called unrealistic optimism. College students believe that they can take on the world and nothing will happen to them. And it was seen in specifically this study, but also mentioned in other studies, and I saw it in mine as well. And also apathy. College students don't really care. They're too focused on whatever test they have that day. So, study results. I looked at the educational impact, which was the original focus of the study. I wanted to see the effect of a pro-immunization statement on college students' opinions. And I also ended up looking at the initial perceptions of immunization, which I found to be really interesting. So, educational impact. So, the test was scored 1 through 13, because there were 13 knowledge-based questions. So, initially, the average was around 9.5, I believe, and it went up about 5%. So about 57% increased their score, 20% maintained, and then 23 actually dropped their score, which I thought was interesting. But I think it was also due to the length of the survey and people's attention time towards the information that they're getting. Also, it was really interesting, people who had a high score initially, a couple of them went down, which was possibly because they second-guessed themselves or for whatever reason. But overall, an improvement. So hopefully college students, when faced with an intervention, they will be able to improve their knowledge. So basically, a fact sheet is effective in educating college students, which is good. So the impact of the pro-immunization statement. So once again, half of the students received just the fact sheet. Half of them received the fact sheet and the pro-immunization statement. Basically, they both had an increase in opinion scores. So I scaled their ethics scores, and out of 5 or 7, it was 8 actually, sorry. And both groups had an increase. And what was interesting was that the pro-immunization group did not have a significant increase compared to just the fact sheet group. So basically, the pro-immunization statement wasn't really much help. If you just provide college students with information about vaccines, they will change their opinions and be more likely, hopefully, to get vaccinated. So, education is effective in improving opinions of immunization among college students, which is great for people to know. So, initial beliefs and perceptions. This is before they received any sort of intervention at all. So you can see the unrealistic optimism, and I am concerned for my own health during outbreaks. Not many people were concerned. And also, the other interesting things to note was less people were concerned about transmission, and also they were not very concerned for other community members' health during flu outbreaks. So these might be important points to consider for another intervention, to focus more on transmission, your own health, and then other community members' health during outbreaks. So education, again, focusing on the risk of susceptibility to influenza and transmission and effect on other community members may be beneficial. So what I found from my research was that basically a pro-immunization propaganda-based pro-immunization campaign that is propaganda-based is maybe not as effective as just simple educational methods. So that might be something for people who are trying to increase college students' immunization in the future to maybe focus less on just telling college students what to do and actually giving them the information and having them decide for themselves. And for sitting through the presentation, you get a nice comic. just based on a song that I'm sure many of you know. Okay, so those are my references, and thank you.
presenters.
So we're going to do Q&A now, so I'm going to invite the four presenters up here, if you don't mind. And because we are recording, we'll be repeating the questions, so we'll ask presenters when you respond to identify yourself before your response. So, go ahead, Todd. Any questions? And it'd be great to also identify yourself, too.
So she asked, who were we targeting when we asked the question, would you be vaccinated? So we actually asked, would you be vaccinated? We didn't initially know who would be coming in. We did have some younger, some in their 20s, who actually were eligible for the vaccine, and we did have some who were very much out of the range, 60, 70. So we asked the question, would you be vaccinated, because we didn't know what age range they would actually be in, but we also asked, would you vaccinate your children, and who would make this decision? So you're correct in that. Our population was 40 years old, so a lot of people said, yes, I would want to be vaccinated. And we would have to have a discussion at the end that although you would like to be vaccinated, we cannot actually apply for the vaccine for you because you are not eligible. Merck will not approve it. So that was kind of a limitation of our study. It would have. We really just wanted to see the thoughts and the knowledge of in specifically Hispanics, because we serve a predominantly Hispanic population, what they knew about HPV and their willingness to vaccinate, and if they were not eligible, we wanted to see if they would vaccinate their children. So does that answer your question?
Yes.
I don't know. Okay, sorry.
I'm Parker Small from the University of Florida. Sorry, I'm late. I thought your talk started at 9:30. Our experience is absolutely compatible with yours. We have been doing a simulation of flu in the classroom, followed by a simulation of flu with half of the class immune. This comparison drives home for high school kids, that we're reporting on at 12:50 today, and college students that we're not reporting on but have studied, that it changes their behavior significantly, primarily because they become aware that although they're immortal and therefore don't need vaccination, but that by getting immunized, they can protect their family and friends. And it's much more effective than all of the stuff about you gotta get immunized. We agree.
Cool, thank you.
Do you want to respond?
No.
So the question was if we use any examples of disease outbreaks with parents. So there's a big pertussis epidemic in Washington State in 2011, or was it 12 or 11? And that was the second year of the Immunity Community Campaign, and I think one baby died, unfortunately, in our state. And that, yeah, it actually really unfortunately helped because people were seeing people in their community getting sick, and it really drove home the fact that most of us need to immunize to protect all of us, especially immunocompromised people or younger people, so forth. So yeah, and we definitely during the training we talk about that although vaccines are diseases are most part gone, you know, they're only a plane ride away, and recent examples like this year, a lot of measles, and that's kind of the aha moment for parent advocates during the training is and what gets them want to become activated in addition to the high exemption rates. You want to add?
Yeah. So I would just add to that that we try not to lead with fear, but at the same time, you know, there have been several cases of measles through SeaTac Airport this year. But another sort of measles-related soundbite that we often use is a lot of parents who come into clinics wanting to do an alternative schedule, right? They get it from Dr. Bob Sears. His waiting room is one of the only ones in the country that's ever had a measles outbreak, and he suggests delaying the measles vaccine until the MMR vaccine, excuse me, until age, dividing and then delaying until age five. So we definitely encourage physicians, if it will work in the context of the interaction, to arm themselves with that type of information. And certainly, as Mackenzie said, the whole one plane right away, et cetera, it's a meaningful approach.
So the question again was, what was the policy change regarding the co-op preschools? So so in our state, we have these cooperative preschools where parents go with their children for 1 or 2 hours a week, and then they also work in the preschool. And there's no immunization requirement as far as turning in a form that shows documentation of immunization status or exemption status. So we, through parent advocates that were part of one of the co-op preschools, they realized this and that they did have forms because they weren't required, but they were asked to be submitted, that they were in complete disarray, that they weren't updated on a regular basis, they weren't, you know, nothing was being done with them. And they took it upon themselves to develop a system for organizing these forms, and then we presented the system to the head of all the co-ops in the state, and they then took these recommendations and incorporated them into their risk management manual, voted on them, and then disseminated these to all of the cooperative preschools in the state. So now each co-op is required to designate somebody to review these forms, to divide them up between those that are at risk of disease, those that are protected, and have steps in the case of an outbreak, what to do. So we see that as a huge success, a policy change that hopefully will have implications for up to 10,000 families in our state. Does that answer your question? And Todd's also working with me this year, too, so I can get him to help answer. So the question is, are parent advocates provided a stipend, and how do I recruit them? So because of the evaluation components, which are pretty hefty, a lot of requirements in the parent advocates to do, we are giving them a stipend that's a very minimal amount for their work over the year. That will go away once the evaluation component is done. And so we are testing this year some of the returning parent advocates. We've taken away the stipend to see if they're still inclined to do as many activities and so forth. But we did ask parent advocates, we surveyed them to see if the stipend made a difference in their work. And they said potentially for getting them, recruiting them, but then that effect went away. They were really rewarded in, you know, just their experience in this program as advocates through the year. So it will be interesting to see this year, however. And then the other question, how do we recruit? So we recruit pilot sites first, so the childcare, preschool, elementary school, and we work with a representative, whether it's a school nurse, childcare director, to identify parents that might be interested in this, and they approach them. We found that's an easier approach to getting recruiting parents versus just sending out a broad message. We're looking for parent advocates, and we found some really great ones, and a lot of them happen to be have some interest, whether they know someone who's had a vaccine preventable disease, or their grandparent had polio, or they work in the medical field, like as an MA or a nurse. So, and we've had some of the parent advocates are now in their third year staying on in the program. Thanks.
Yeah, so that, that is, we should have mentioned that actually. So we are emphatic at Vax Northwest about not taking any pharmaceutical dollars. So all of our money right now comes from, or the vast majority of our money comes from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation and the Group Health Foundation. So Group Health, the local cooperative, contributes significant resources to this as well.
We're looking for funding.
Yeah.
So I'm super fascinated by this type of question. I don't have anything definitive to offer you. I would say that younger physicians tend to express more skepticism than older physicians. And one of the things that I'm really glad we did was the evaluation surveys that I mentioned. So this isn't any sort of statistically robust piece of the study, but every time I present or I present with the pediatrician who works with me, we get evaluated. I've never had someone out themselves as vaccine hesitant in the training session. I certainly have on the survey where I get these sort of scathing comments about, you know, how the work is done and that we should need to be more respectful of providers who are vaccine hesitant. The only other thing I would say is that just in September, there was a conference that happened at the American Academy of Arts and Sciences called Public Trust in Vaccines, and that was one of the outcomes that group decided. So, like, we need to know if healthcare providers are our allies in this or not, because there's this assumption that, in fact, providers are really strongly endorse this. And even, I mean, anecdotally, 2 weeks ago, I was at a clinic north of Seattle, and there's a physician there who just out and out, like, is herself vaccine hesitant and only does it because she's told she has to by the system. So I don't think we can offer any sort of useful data about that, but I think it's a really ripe area for research and inquiry.
And I think there was actually a study done in Washington State of physicians, and the vaccine hesitancy was lower, but there's no knowledge about other providers, nurses or medical assistants, and that's maybe where some of the hesitancy.
There's a study in Rhode Island of healthcare providers, including nurses, showing that there's a great deal of hesitancy, and one of the biggest issues that we face at the state is getting on the right side.
Yeah.
Yeah. So the question is reaching out to mothers who are pregnant or parents who are expecting a child. I don't know what the literature says. I know that that's like an important next step for the work of Vax Northwest is to work with prenatal providers in particular, and especially getting the Hep B birth dose on the table. That is really, like, you've got to talk about that in advance of offering that immunization. Parents really don't appreciate being confronted with that in the moment. It's, you know, it's obviously an overwhelming time. I think you should talk about the Group Health Smart Set.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Early on in Vax Northwest, we've been very lucky to work with some doctor of nursing practice students, some DNP students at the University of Washington, and we did some needs assessment and then a pilot test at Group Health in some clinics where we were seeing if the provider, the OB and midwives there would bring up the hepatitis B birth dose, because there's some literature that says if parents don't immunize with the hepatitis B birth dose, they're less likely to continue on time on schedule for future. So a lot of that was just acceptance by OBs and midwives to see if they would be willing to bring that up, because that's been some of the hesitation in that community that we've found is they don't want to go there and have that discussion about childhood vaccines. They're starting to be more likely to have discussions about Tdap and flu. But that is something that we're interested in working with. And certainly, I think through the community intervention, these, especially parents of children in these child care and preschool settings, they're interacting with a lot of their peers who are pregnant and so forth. So, yeah, the upstream approach is absolutely where we want to go.
So the question is if there's if the two sort of bodies of work have any integration, and other than sort of theoretically and philosophically, the answer is no. They're deliberately discrete bodies of work.
But that's not to say they may.
Yeah, there probably is some cross fertilization that we don't know about, as much as you know we're attempting to keep them apart. But
And that's also eventually our approach, is that we know parents are getting information from the media, from providers, from their social networks, and so we purposely chose to take the media part out of that. But we know it's a holistic approach to reaching parents.
Bert
Wilkie,
I just wanted to make a comment
I
guess more than a question. It intrigues me that what was identified by CDC in 2000 as one of the 10 greatest accomplishments of the 20th century, immunization, is now something that's called into question. And it seems to me that if we go further upstream, there are some issues that are kind of at play here around anti-government movements and conspiracy theorists, coupled with, I think, a general lack of scientific literacy. Not only among the general public, but also among providers and others. There was a book called The Panic Virus by Seth Newcomb, which is an amazing book. And I think I had the chance of hearing him talk and saying how he came at this from someone who had no scientific background. But it took him a year, really, to research that book and to come to the full realization and understanding of the value of immunization. Is there something we can do, short of having people read the book or spend a year educating themselves, to improve their educational knowledge around immunizations and the field of immunology and vaccines?
I don't know if I want to attempt to summarize that. but, you know, it's sort of what can we do about this lack of literacy about that. So one of the things I want to say, Seth Nukin, who wrote The Panic Virus, he was one of the organizers of the Public Trust in Vaccines conference that just concluded last month. So, you know, that work is progressing, and he's aligning himself with the scientific community to come up with a research agenda. So that's an exciting development. This question, you know, there's this constant tension, right, that there's, like, if people just understand the science better, they'll do this. The challenge in Washington State is that we're an exception, and especially the counties where we're working, exceptionally highly educated population, affluent, typically white people, right? So they, like, they, on paper at least, should be qualified to understand the science, and yet, so, you know, there's the conspiracy thing perhaps, right? Like, so is pharma in bed with the CDC? There's, you know, the issue, I think, in Washington State that's probably most salient is this, like, idea of green living or being sort of off of that pharmacological grid, if you will. And people believing in natural immunity as well is another really significant issue, right? So, like, we often show a video where there's a mom who talks really positively about chickenpox parties and, you know, and that type of thing. So it's also very socioeconomic and demographically, spatially specific as well. There's just so much that needs to be teased out here, which is why we went about this as a communication intervention, right? Like, how you have the conversation. We are researching the really significant salient piece here. I don't know if anybody else wants to jump in. Okay.
Civil rights parent advocates
identify themselves as kind of attachment parents who is, and they're like, it's not mutually exclusive. I mean, you can be an attachment parent and co-sleep and do extended breastfeeding, and you can vaccinate your kids. You know, those two don't have to be separate from each other, which is in our state in certain pockets. That's some of the reasons why parents don't vaccinate.
Sorry,
I lied.
We actually have time for one more question. So, do we have a burning question or comment or story to share? Yes.
I just have a comment, and my colleague is giving up. He said I'm from the FDA office of vaccine, but I am not speaking. But these educated women of our middle income, they tend to be trendsetters for everybody else in terms of their parenting behaviors or other behaviors. So, I mean, if this is a trend in that population, they need it to be really, really paying attention to that because others will fall there.
Yeah, that's exactly why we're doing the immunity community and working with a peer-to-peer approach.